I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday. Let the melting begin. Orioles opening day is next Thursday, and voting in Maryland's June primary election begins in just 11 weeks. Today, we continue our series of conversations with the candidates. Ben Jealous is my guest. He's one of nine Democrats running in the primary for governor. He's the youngest person ever to lead the NAACP. He's a partner in a socially aware investment firm and a visiting professor at Princeton University. This is his first time pursuing elective office. A vigorous supporter of Senator Bernie Sanders in the 2016 election, can he appeal to moderates in the Democratic Party? And if he prevails in the primary, does he have what it takes to beat a very popular incumbent governor? Ben Jealous joins me right after the news. Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks to everybody who made a pledge in our spring membership campaign. The pledge drive ended yesterday, but what won't end is our commitment to bring you news and information the best way we know how. So we appreciate your interest in our work. We appreciate your listening, and we appreciate your financial support. Thank you very much. Today on Midday, we continue our series of conversations with the candidates who will be on the June 26th primary ballot here in Maryland. Early voting begins June 14th. Today, my guest is Ben Jealous, a Democratic candidate for governor. Last May, when he stood in front of his cousin's flower shop in Baltimore's Ashburton neighborhood and jumped into the race, he was only the second Democrat to announce his candidacy. Well, now he has plenty of company. There will be nine Democrats on the ballot in June, and the winner will go up against Republican Governor Larry Hogan in the general election next November. Ben Jealous is perhaps best known as the former president and CEO of the NAACP. When he was appointed to that position in 2008, he was, at 35 years old, the youngest person ever to lead the NAACP. He was there for more than 5 years. When he left in 2013, he joined Caper Capital as a partner and investor. It's a progressive investment firm based in Oakland, California. He manages the firm's Baltimore office. He's also a visiting professor at the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs at Princeton University. He is a former community organizer, and early in his career, he was a journalist. He is 45 years old. He lives in Anne Arundel County, and he's the father of two children. Ben Jealous joins me in Studio A, and we are streaming live on the WIPR Facebook page. It's good to see you, sir. Welcome back.
Thank you, Tom. Always good to see you, brother.
So you are no stranger to politics by any means, but you're one of several first-time candidates for elective office. So with all the stuff that you have done, the platform, the national platform that you have, particularly in the area of civil rights, police reform, why elective office and why this one in particular?
Yeah, I'm running for office to get our state back to moving forward again. It was not too long ago that we were making big leaps forward. I mean, back in 2013, I was named Marylander of the Year by the Baltimore Sun, because in 1 year, I led the successful effort to abolish the death penalty just a few years after the governor himself had tried and not succeeded. I co-chaired the successful effort to pass the DREAM Act. And I put organizers on the ground to help deliver the victory in marriage equality. We have an opportunity right now to get our families moving forward, no matter what happens in Donald Trump's Washington. But it means that we're going to have to come together. And our campaign, this, you know, Susie Turnbull and I, our campaign for governor and
lieutenant governor.
Yeah, she's my running mate. Mm-hmm. We're focused on pulling folks together to get back to doing big things again.
What's the capacity of state government, in your view, your political philosophy of what the state can do as a governmental entity?
You know, the most important lesson I ever learned in college was in judo class. Judo, you're taught, first lesson, you shall use your opponent's momentum against them. And that's why a woman who was a 5'1" black belt swept the floor with me, literally, like every practice. Well, the momentum of the far right wing that now controls every branch of our federal government has been the states' rights movement. And if you want to know why they control all three branches of our federal government, consider first that they've taken control of 3 dozen of our states' governorships, including ours. And they've, throughout that states' rights movement concentrated power in the states. So the irony in this dystopian moment of Donald Trump as president is that because of the states' rights movement, we actually have a lot of power in our states that we can use to move forward. I'm running for office to make sure that everybody in our state has health care when they need it without fear of being driven into poverty. I'm running for office to make sure that we fully fund our schools. I'm running office to make sure that we end this era of massive student debt. We pay for it in part by ending mass incarceration. And we have the power to do all of that right here in the state of Maryland.
When it comes to the Democratic Party, because you're, as we mentioned, in a crowded field for in this primary, because you're, if anybody in this race has progressive bona fides, it's you. Sure. You're not the only one, but you certainly have, you know, very strong progressive bona fides. Just today, I read on Twitter that Kamala Harris became another one of the national figures associated with the left to endorse you. But in terms of the electability of a person on the left, a progressive candidate in this moment, because the other thing that the Trump moment has shown some Democrats, for example, i.e. the election that just happened last week in Pennsylvania 18, where a conservative Democrat took a Republican seat, you know, a sure bet Republican seat. A conservative or a moderate Democrat is Ralph Northam is now the governor of Virginia. And when we had a left candidate to the left in John Ossoff, for example, in an early special election, he lost to the Republican in that particular state. Is Maryland progressive as a state, the state as a whole, Eastern Maryland, Western Maryland? Is a progressive person the best person, the best placed person to be on the ballot against a conservative but highly popular Republican governor?
You know, I've said repeatedly in this race, and I am a progressive. I don't, you know, I co-chaired Bernie Sanders' campaign in our state. But as far as the policies that we're pushing, those policies will transform the lives of the better people regardless of their party. Making sure that we have a real response to the opioid epidemic isn't a partisan issue. It's a human issue. We need to shift away from failed war and drug strategies, like what Hogan's pushing, and treat addiction as a health issue. Education, making sure that we get back to our public universities being truly affordable. You know, when my granddad went to the University of Maryland School of Law for 1 year, helped him become a probation officer back in the late 1950s, third class of black students admitted, it was $200 tuition. By 1970, it was 410. Today, it should be 2,600 if kept up with inflation. It's 31,000. That's not a partisan issue. And so what we find is that those sorts of kitchen table issues, actually presenting real solutions to the big problems that vex all of our families, yes, it appeals to the left. It also appeals to a lot of folks on the right. I was out on the Eastern Shore. In a backyard early in this campaign, and a man disclosed he had voted for Donald Trump and then told the crowd of 100 people assembled that he'd be voting for me because I'm for single payer. I'm for state-based Medicare for all. And, you know, that's what we need to understand. We got to stop thinking of people as being kind of linear. It's more on a circle. And the way that you win in Maryland, quite frankly, is to excite Democrats to turn out. But we shouldn't be foolish enough to think that it's only Democrats who want to end mass incarceration, end massive student debt, make sure everybody can afford their health care, and deal with the big kitchen table issues that vex our families. I'm the only candidate in this race whose support is truly statewide, whose support is even across the major demographic groups. We're running the only statewide, truly statewide campaign for governor in this race. And that's what we'll do when we move into the general against Hogan. Hogan was only in office because Democrats didn't show up. And when you talk to Democrats, you know, the lesson of 2014 was we've really got to put organizers on the ground. The lesson of 2016 is we've got to provide real solutions to the big economic issues. The Democrats who swing between voting and not voting, they tend to not turn out when they feel betrayed on the economy.
And to the showing up issue.
Yep.
As you mentioned, you ran Bernie Sanders' campaign here in Maryland. You were an outspoken supporter of Mr. Sanders. There's a narrative about the 2016 election that said that the Sanders camp was late to the game coming in support of the eventual nominee, Mrs. Clinton. The bifurcation, both politically and just sort of emotionally, between the Sanders camp and the Clinton camp was still too prevalent by the time we got to November. And there were people on the left who didn't show up to support Secretary Clinton. Do you think that the Democratic Party here in Maryland is united? Do you sense that there is a rift between the two camps in the party? And of course, Mr. Sanders, for the record, is an independent. He's not even registered in the Democratic Party, but he caucuses with the Democrats, of course, and he's considered a progressive person when it comes to his political philosophy. But given the context of the National Democratic Party and the flummoxed state in which it found itself after November 6th, is the Maryland Democratic Party, again, ready to rally around a person who's as closely associated with the progressive cause as you are?
Yeah. Susie Turnbull, my running mate, is a former chairman of the Maryland Democratic Party. And Travis Tazel, our campaign manager, is a former executive director. And what we found is that the people of the state are absolutely ready to unite. I was the first Bernie Sanders surrogate to endorse Hillary after he did, and the only one who didn't get booed at the DNC doing it, because I'm good at pulling folks together. When the polls were done afterwards by Priorities USA, the PAC associated with the Clinton campaign, they found out was that the margins of victory in places like Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin,
sure,
the upper Midwest, came from two sets of voters. One were white working class voters who switched from having voted for Obama to voting for Trump. The other were black working class voters who switched from having voted for Obama to not voting. On each case, they felt betrayed in the economy. The lesson for us, is less to look inward about infighting from 2016. It's more to look backwards to who used to inspire us to be Democrats. Because when you look backwards and you say to folks, why did you become a Democrat? Who inspired you to be a Democrat? You typically end up with a transformative woman like Barbara Mikulski or Shirley Chisholm, or you end up with a man that we remember by three initials, whether it's FDR, or it's RFK, or it's MLK. And what all of them have in common is that in addition to fighting for civil rights and fighting to build the economy for everybody, they fought to end poverty. Our party's been too close to Wall Street for too long. And we have forgotten that a core pillar of being a Democrat is being absolutely committed to ending poverty. This campaign, at its core, what Susie and I are fighting for is, yes, to expand the economy, to defend the civil rights of everyone, and to end poverty. That commitment will bring more Democrats back to the fold than anything else we can do. We are the party of RFK and FDR and MLK and Shirley Chisholm and Barbara Mikulski. And when we embrace that proudly and openly without looking over our shoulder, no one can stop us.
I think it's pretty easy to discern what a jealous administration would look like as opposed to a Hogan administration.
Sure.
The disparities in your political philosophies are pretty clear.
I'm not out there touring the state with Betsy DeVos or parroting Jeff Sessions.
For the record, that's absolutely true. Haven't seen you once in a picture with Betsy DeVos. Democratic voters in the primary have to decide who's the best person positioned to beat Mr. Hogan, if that's in fact what they would like to do, to return the state house in Annapolis to the Democratic Party. So what would be the difference between a Ben Jealous administration than a Rashurn Baker or a Kevin Kamenetz or a Jim Shea or a Maddaleno or a Ross administration?
You know, I'm running as, I guess, you know, we all have many facets. And part of what defines me is I was trained by a social worker, is now 101, who also helped train Barbara Mikulski. And that's my grandmother, Miss Mamie Todd. You know, Senator Mikulski told me that my grandma helped her learn how not to feel awkward as a young social worker. And when she said that, I just smiled because thought to myself, wow, she did a really good job, because I've never seen Barbara Mikulski look awkward at all.
Awkward is not the word we associate with Senator Mikulski.
My grandma trained me to understand that you can't half solve a problem. If you half solve a problem, you still got a problem, and it might get worse. And so what you can expect from my administration is that we will seek to solve whole problems. We're not going to nibble around the edges of the healthcare crisis in our state and the way prices keep surging up and try to sell you some so-called public option that, you know, every credible think tank, including the RAND Corporation, which was started by the U.S. Air Force and as centrist as it gets, will tell you won't cost much because it won't do much. No, we will level with you and say we have one option to get the healthcare costs under control, and that is to do what England does, what Canada does, what, you know, every other Western nation does, and provide healthcare for everybody.
And we're going to pick it up there when we come back. We will talk about healthcare. We'll talk about criminal justice reform. We'll talk about reforming the Baltimore City Police Department. We'll talk about immigration. We'll try to get to as many issues as we can today, and we will take your phone calls, your tweets, and your emails for Ben Jealous. He is the former president and CEO of the NAACP and one of nine Democrats running in the June primary for the chance to face Republican Governor Larry Hogan in the general election come November. If you have questions, our number 410-662-8780. Our email midday@wipr.org. You can find us in the Twittersphere @MiddayWIPR, and we are streaming live on the WIPR Facebook page. More with Ben Jealous in 90 seconds. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. Welcome back. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up Monday on our program, another in our series of conversations with the candidates, Democrat incumbent Maryland Attorney General Brian Frosch joins me here in Studio A, and I'll also speak with Asianae Phillips. She's a seventh grader from Hampstead Hill Academy. That's a Baltimore City public school. She'll be attending the March for Our Lives in Washington tomorrow, and on Monday here on Midday, we'll get her perspective on that experience. If you're just joining us today, my guest is Ben Jealous. He's one of nine candidates running in the June primary to be the Democratic nominee for governor. You can hear all of our conversations with the candidates at wipr.org/midday. You are welcome to be part of our conversation with Ben Jealous. 410-662-8780. Our email midday@wipr.org. Our Twitter handle @MiddayWIPR. And we are streaming on the WIPR Facebook page. So, Ben Jealous, you are proposing to create a universal health care system. You say that we don't have to wait for the federal government to do that. It certainly doesn't seem like they're in a hurry to do that anytime soon. You call it Medicare for All. This seems to be somewhat resonant and similar to the plan that Bernie Sanders adduced during the 2016 campaign. How does that work? How can you do that just in the state of Maryland, given the current climate in Washington about the ACA?
Well, you know, it starts with us pulling together in January 2019, once we switch hands between Hogan and me, pulling together a commission. It's, the bill is very similar to the bill that now Kamala Harris and Cory Booker, in addition to Bernie Sanders, have all sponsored. And that commission will have the major employers, major unions, nurses, doctors, consumers, and every major interest group around a table to figure out how we work out the details so that this adds up to a better deal for everybody. Now, there's reason to be optimistic. Just get into the numbers for a second. If you don't cut overhead by half, you'll cut overhead by three quarters or more, because private insurance in our country, nonprofit or for-profit, the overhead hovers around 18-19%. France, England, Canada, it's about 8-9%. For Medicare, Medicaid, it's 3%. So we can cut overhead a lot, one. Two, a lot of what's driving up healthcare costs is pharmaceuticals. I've met 80-year-old woman, introduced herself to me as a member of the working poor. And I said, what do you mean? She said, well, I'm back in the workforce at 80, taking care of a 96-year-old man because I can't afford to pay my pharmaceutical bills. You know, I've held a man in my arms who was sobbing because his girlfriend, a 52-year-old psychologist in Montgomery County, world-renowned in her field, had dropped dead because she had lost her job, couldn't afford her pharmaceuticals, and began, you know, rationing them and went into seizure and died of asphyxiation from a seizure. And
no one would deny that the problem is very severe.
And so here's the thing. Those pills in this country, if they don't cost twice as much as they do in England or Canada, they cost five times as much. And the federal government won't let the federal government negotiate a better deal, but it has carved out a loophole for states so we can negotiate a better deal. When you look at the study that was done on California, what they figured out was that they could cover everybody in the state for just 10% more than they had paid that year. Well, our costs here in Maryland are so out of control, they go up more than 10% every year.
But and California, forgive me for interrupting, California is an interesting example because it's a Democratic-controlled legislature, and obviously Governor Brown is a Democrat, but the efforts to have essentially a Medicare-for-all system in California have stalled. I mean, they haven't been able to get it actually done.
And so the... And that comes into the politics. And Gavin Newsom, who's a lieutenant governor, who's running for a governor now, said that when he's governor, he will get it done. There's no doubt there will be a real fight from industries that are economically addicted to economically exploiting citizens when it comes to, you know, like for instance, the pharmaceutical industry. And that's, I think, you know, part of the difference in my leadership is I actually have the courage to stand up to them. It's something I've done as president of the NAACP repeatedly and throughout my career. You know, somebody asked me, you know, what my NRA rating was, because Hogan has an A rating, A minus, but, you know, and he's in the A category. And I said, well, you know, I haven't had the opportunity for them to give me an F yet, but I'm pretty sure there's still a wanted poster somewhere around their headquarters for me from my days at the NAACP. So I have no problem standing up to industry. You know, the last thing is that there's real reason to be hopeful that we can get the cost under control by shifting, because we've already made a big shift towards it. You know, we have the hospital waiver that nobody else has, and that's allowed us to create this all-payer system where our hospitals are only allowed to charge one rate to any insurer. They can't charge different rates to different insurers. Every insurer they have to charge the same rate to. And it's already saved our state about $500 million.
And what about the cost to taxpayers? I mean, in Vermont, Peter Shumlin was elected governor in 2010. Yeah. He promised to have Medicare for all by 2014. He had bailed on that promise because he said that the cost to taxpayers in Vermont would be exorbitant. I mean, is it affordable as far as you can tell? I mean, how do you think it's affordable?
As a state, Vermont's the size of Baltimore.
Right.
We are about, give or take, 10 times larger than Vermont. The state of Oregon is about two-thirds our size. And the Rand Corporation looked at Oregon and said that the most expensive option was the status quo, that the public option wouldn't cost much because it wouldn't do much, just maintain the political will to maintain the status quo, and that the most viable option was to go to a state-based single-payer or so-called Medicare-for-all program. If the Rand Corporation is certain that Oregon could do it with a population of 4 million, I feel very confident that we could do it with a population that's more than 50% larger. Now, the other thing is that
And the largeness would then give us more leverage, for example, in pharmaceuticals
greater leverage, greater economies of scale.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the other thing, Tom, is that we have a much larger portion of our population covered by federal insurances, you know, federal workers, military, et cetera, than California does, given our proximity to the federal government and the large bases in our state that's relatively small compared to California. And so that gives us, I think, reason to be optimistic that we can do it for less than 10% if it was going to be 10% in California. The last thing I'd say is, it's urgent that we do this. You know, I spent 6 months of my life seeking to move a factory from Edmonton, Canada, to South Baltimore. It's a block over on East Reedbird Street, about three-quarters of which is a public housing project, not dissimilar from McCullough Homes in West Baltimore, where my mom spent half her childhood. And one-quarter of that block is a public housing project. Sorry, I mean, one-quarter of that block is a brownfield. And on that brownfield, we were going to put a lettuce farm where they grow lettuce and steel storage containers for the Orthodox Jewish market. And day one, it would have had three dozen good-paying jobs with health care, low skill, could have hired from those public housing projects. Day 1,000, we estimated 300. The deal was sailing along for months. It fell apart. The entrepreneur woke up in a cold sweat one night and started Googling the volatility in Maryland's health care costs. And he called me, woke me up, and said, "Hey, I'm sitting here, I'm looking, you know, in the exchange, your healthcare costs at that point had gone up 55% in 3 years." He said, "Do you think that they're going to go up again?" I said, "Yeah, probably. Why?" He said, "Well, then I can't do the deal, man." And less than 6 months later, they jumped up 30% again. And so we have to understand that unleashing the power of our economy is incumbent upon us getting our healthcare costs under control. It's been a quarter century since Bill Clinton first.
And is it going to be one state at a time then? Because it's not going to be at the federal level.
See, that's how they started in Canada. And mm-hmm. that's how we'll have to be prepared to start here. Now, to get the last waivers that we need, we will need a president who's willing to approve experiments in the states. That means that we will need a different president than Donald Trump. I'm totally down for that, too.
I bet.
But, you know, and quite frankly.
I'm shocked.
Yeah, and quite frankly, I believe that the movement for state-based Medicare for all, single payer, is part of what's going to help us build the movement to get rid of Donald Trump.
Ben Jealous is one of nine people running for the Democratic nomination for governor. 410-662-8780. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWYPR. And we are streaming live on the WYPR Facebook page. Couple of comments on the Facebook live stream. Trish and Dorothy both write that they are all for you. They are inspired, and I would do anything to push this man into the governor's mansion. And then on Twitter, Dengray writes, and this is again a political question. We talked about it a little bit in the first section. Dengray says, "I have to say that I can't vote for a person who ran the Bernie Sanders campaign. Bernie and his folks gave us Trump. Even today, they still attack the Democratic Party 24/7. I like Ben, but we have other progressive choices, and the Bernie connection is a deal breaker." So that may be something you're going to have to deal with.
You know, the people of the state have moved on. And I understand that there's folks who, independent folks here or there, individuals rather here or there who are still stuck 2018. But most of us realize that it's got to be #Ford. And that we've got to focus on winning in 2018. And the only way we win is we come back together. The moment that we start creating litmus tests in our own party, "Oh, if you supported this person in 2016 or this, I'm not going to work with you," is the moment that we turn over the governor's office to the Republicans permanently. My running mate, Susie Turnbull, was for Hillary Clinton in the primary. I was for Bernie. I co-chaired his campaign in the state. I was for Bernie in the primary. We were both for Hillary in the general. And it's that ability to have robust debate in the primaries and then come together that makes us strong. And when people, insist on staying apart, we can only get weaker. Susie and I are the only ones who are building a truly unifying campaign. And you can see it in our endorsements from Bernie and from Cory Booker and Kamala Harris and even Eric Garcetti, four of the hopefuls for the 2020 nomination for president in the Democratic Party. You can see it in the fact that we've been endorsed by unions like SEIU that supported Hillary and the National Nurses who supported Bernie. We keep pulling folks back together. I learned the art of doing that young. I was a 14-year-old precinct captain for Jesse Jackson. And I can remember when Reverend Jackson got all of us on the phone, called nationally, and asked us to go support Michael Dukakis. Michael Dukakis is a wonderful man in many ways, but the charisma deficit between Michael Dukakis and Jesse Jackson is monumental. And when you're 14, 15 years old and you're told to switch from Reverend Jackson to Governor Dukakis, well, I learned how just to suck it up and go do it. And the reality was it was the right thing. And so I would say, my brother, please feel free to, reach out to me on Twitter, DM me. Let's talk. We've got to come back together. When we come back together, we get stronger. And the reality is that the Democratic Party is bigger, has more young people in it, and is closer to the kind of FDR, MLK, Shirley Chisholm, RFK, kind of roots of the party because of Senator Sanders' platform. I was the one at the DNC platform committee. Bill McKibben reminded a bunch of people this the other day as his organization was endorsing us. In the back rooms, we were pulling the Clinton folks and the Sanders folks together to craft that platform and to get so many unanimous portions of the platform through. And when I'm governor, you can expect me to do the same in our state.
Let's talk a little bit about criminal justice reform and police reform. This is an issue that you've been very much in the vanguard of. Yep. I mean, we talk 3 years ago after the Freddie Gray uprising with some recommendations that you had for reforming the police. We've just had this week this horrible incident in Sacramento, California. Stephen Clark, a young man, 20 years old, shot by police in the backyard of his grandmother's house where he was living.
The backyard of his grandmother's house. Just think about that sentence.
It's incredible. Now, Mr. Clark's actions prior to the shooting are a little unclear now, but what is very clear is that he was not armed. He did not have a weapon. He had a cell phone, and they fired 20 rounds at him and killed him. The police reform efforts here in Baltimore, we have a consent decree, we have a new police commissioner, we have a mayor who said that she's committed to reforming the police department. What can this state do, and what would you do as governor to aid not only the city of Baltimore, but other police departments in jurisdictions around the state to improve the behavior and the efficacy of police departments?
The state can make police in our state again accountable to civilians. It's a core concept going back to the American Revolution. The state can make sure that our officers are the best trained in the country and that we have one use of force standard across the entire state, and that it's both the training and the standards are state of the art. And the state can make sure that we are recruiting and retaining the best officers. Not everybody who wants to be an officer should be an officer. And if you're of the narrow band of personalities that are most likely to kill somebody unnecessarily, you shouldn't be. If your biases against other groups are so deeply ingrained that there's no getting you away from them, you shouldn't be. And we can test for both those things and weed folks like that out. But the most important thing we can do is to make sure that our officers are accountable to all of us. And that starts with having a special prosecutor to oversee every case of alleged wrongdoing in the state.
Would be a statewide position.
Yeah, it's similar.
New position.
Something similar to what Governor Rockefeller did in New York decades ago. Very effective there, even though he made some other mistakes in criminal justice. This was one of the good things he did. And so important. I mean, if you look at the Gun Trace Task Force trial, what do we learn? We learned that the officers were tried internally by three officer panels, and one of those officers, at least on that panel, appeared to be corrupted and in cahoots with them. We learned that inside of the Internal Affairs Division, they had moles who were giving them information. We've got to do better than that. And the way you do better than that is you put civilians in control.
And that's a function of the state rather than the city or any other jurisdiction, Prince George's, Montgomery, Frederick, Hagerstown, all of whom have had issues with police departments.
The special prosecutor, absolutely. Baltimore City's police department's been a dual jurisdiction agency, a state and city agency, since the Civil War. So in the case of Baltimore, absolutely. And and we also have to reform the Law Enforcement Officers Bill of Rights, which is a state piece of legislation that still has a 5-day waiting period. When a police officer is accused of murder, the officers who are investigating the murder deserve to be able to interrogate him like any other civilian who's been accused of murder. And the fact that we give this waiting period, quite frankly, is just official sanction of a type of kind of lowercase corruption that we should have no part of. I mean, remember, it's not just Freddie Gray or Gun Trace Task Force. Before that, what it was like, 36 or more officers at the Baltimore City Jail, and it only came to our attention that they had been corrupted because four officers got pregnant by the same inmate, who was himself a shot caller in a large gang. So we've got real issues that we have to root out. You know, my granddad spent 3 decades on law enforcement in Baltimore City. He's what inspired me to study criminology. I teach criminal justice policy now. And our young people deserve for police officers to be heroes to them without any static about corruption and unnecessary killings. The only way that we get there is we have the courage to actually take on the police union and ultimately do what so many major city chiefs say that we need to do, which is to better train our officers, better recruit our officers, and make sure that our departments are accountable to the people of the state.
Got to take a break. We'll come right back. Ben Jealous is a Democratic candidate running in the primary for governor. He's the former president and CEO of the NAACP. His running mate is Susan Turnbull of Bethesda. She's the former chair of the Maryland Democratic Party. 410-662-8780. That's our number here at Midday. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWYPR. We are streaming on the WYPR Facebook page. We'll be back in 90 seconds. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, Ben Jealous is here. He's one of nine Democrats running for governor of Maryland. He's the former president and CEO of the NAACP. He's the Baltimore-based partner of a California investment firm and a visiting professor at Princeton University in the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs. His opponents in the June primary include Rashurin Baker, Kevin Kamenetz, Alec Ross, Richard Mottolano, Jim Shea, Krish Vignaraja, and a couple of other folks. If you have questions for Ben Jealous, our number here, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. We're on Twitter, @MiddayWYPR, and we are streaming live on the WYPR Facebook page. A bunch of folks want to talk to you. Linda in Baltimore, welcome to Midday with Ben Jealous.
Hello.
Hey,
sir,
Linda.
I need your help. I'm a senior, and I live here in Baltimore. My house has been robbed, vandalized, firebombed. I don't get help from the Northwest District of the police. These people have been terrorizing me and trying to run me out of my home since I came back to Baltimore in 98. I need help, and I have not gotten any. What suggestions can you make for the seniors that are being terrorized by the drug dealers and trying to be forced out of their homes?
Well, please give your contact information to the show. If you call back in, and they'll give it to me, and we'll reach out. It sounds terrifying, and I'm sorry that you have to live through that. We have got to get back to putting first things first as far as law enforcement priorities. You know, when I announced I was running for governor, I said we will, while I'm governor, both end mass incarceration and get more killers in prison. And I said that as somebody who's had two family members shot in Maryland in the last 10 years, including one who was murdered at age 18, and the other was in his 70s and had agreed to testify against local drug dealers. And when he opened the front door, they shot him in the stomach in warning. Our police officers have been distracted too long. There's a failed theory they call broken windows, where they try to get officers to focus on very small things, hoping that'll stop big things. It really doesn't work that way. And what you've seen is that over time, on average, officers, Baltimore City, for instance, have solved fewer homicides than they used to, although they say in the last year or so maybe there's been some improvement, but I question some of those numbers.
They would say it's up almost 20% from prior years.
Yeah. But if you look across the decades, the trend has been like this, going down. And so you've got to get back to a place where our homicide unit is the size that it should be. It's too small right now. Where our special victims unit is large enough, because we have thousands of rape kits that go unopened across the state every year, where the clerks and the labs that support them are also properly staffed, and where our officers understand that job one is to solve homicide and rape and home evasions, and everything else is frankly job two. And so that's part of why I've also been out there saying that we need to legalize cannabis, because one, it takes a big area of distraction away from the officers. It also will bring down the violence in the city. We interviewed police commanders across the city confidentially, and they all, while they were mystified relatively speaking, about what had gone up, why homicides had jumped up so much then in the last 2 years, now in the last 3 years. They were all in agreement that in the last 10 years, about half the homicides were one set of weed dealers enforcing on another set of weed dealers.
And the state can have an impact in this regard, right? I mean, what is Mr. Hogan not doing that a Governor Jealous would do to reform and to improve the efficacy of the Baltimore City Police Department, and for that matter, any other police department in the state?
So Hogan didn't show up, you know, so for a long time we've had a coordinating council that state officials, Baltimore City officials, work on criminal justice issues. Hogan missed every meeting for almost 3 years, and then threw a fit when they didn't want to rubber stamp his proposals after he hadn't talked to them for almost 3 years, and then went to a meeting just to shut it down. So one thing I would do is lead. I would actually be active, and I would respect the responsibility of the governor to be to play a role in making sure there's effective law enforcement in Baltimore. Why? Because it's been a dual jurisdiction agency, a state and local agency since the Civil War. Two, we would make sure that the state police are being used in ways that are most effective to enhance local law enforcement. One of the things we can do, and on the eve of the March for Our Lives, I think is worth talking about, is to actually be more aggressive in shutting down the trade in illegal guns coming into our state. We have very tough gun laws. Now, we need to go further. We have a big old AR-15 loophole, for example, in our assault weapons ban, which means we don't really have a full assault weapons ban, because that's the only thing an AR-15 is. But when you look at the guns that are used in crimes and used to terrorize people in their homes and throughout our state, they tend to come very often from other states as far away as Maine. And the state police could be playing a bigger, more aggressive role in shutting down that trade in.
What about the judiciary? Because Governor Hogan's approach to law enforcement to some large extent, has to do with mandatory minimums.
Senate Bill
122 is now moving its way through, and it's likely to pass, which imposes mandatory minimum sentences. And this reflects, if I'm understanding it correctly, a sort of general distrust in the judiciary to mete out appropriate sentences. How do you respond to that approach?
It's failed. What he's proposing, new mandatory minimums and truth in sentencing, are failed war on drugs strategies. Again, study after study showed not only didn't work, that they also were very, very expensive. What New York City's doing is working, on the other hand. New York City, when I was president of the NAACP, we worked them, helped pass something called the Community Safety Act. It outlawed racial profiling. It put very high levels of funding into programs like what we call Safe Streets here in Baltimore. And it also expanded the use of gun courts.
There's sort of specialized courts like drug courts are,
yes,
or renter's courts.
Yes, mm-hmm. That simply get through the backlog and make sure people are punished quickly and the guns are taken out of their hands and they deal with them quickly and they're not out there on backlogs, while they're walking around the streets with guns. And in criminology, one thing that's been proven again and again is that the length of the punishment doesn't have any real impact as far as deterrence. That's why the death penalty is an effective deterrent. But the certainty of punishment does. And so one thing that the gun courts have done in New York City is to make it much more certain that if you're caught with an illegal gun, you'll be punished and you'll be punished quickly. That's something that we should be focused on. Larry Hogan is literally recycling failed, expensive strategies from the war on drugs. He should level with the people of Maryland, tell us why the NRA gave him an A rating, and he should tell us how much all this is going to cost. Because the reality is that what he's doing, frankly, a lot of judges oppose because they know it's a massive waste of very limited criminal justice resources.
See if we can get a couple more calls here in the time we have remaining, which is limited. Debbie in Baltimore, welcome to Midday with Ben Jealous.
Thank you.
Hey, Debbie.
Hi. I'm going to give you a curve.
All right.
Let's revisit YouGov 1970, when city governments had decisions. And there's a real problem here that I see in Baltimore City and county. The budgets for the two should be married together. Those academic resources, which would help Baltimore be able to keep their schools up to date, keep their infrastructure up to date, everything, instead of having one at the mercy of the other.
All right, thank you for that call, Debbie. That's an interesting thing. UNIGOV back in 1970 was when Baltimore County and Baltimore City became separate jurisdictions, or perhaps even before that. I'm not exactly sure of the date. Any thought to combining the jurisdictions?
You know, I have not given that much thought, and I would need to study it. I literally think the last conversation I had on that topic was 20 years ago. What I would say is that we do need to be very concerned about, when it comes to education, she mentioned education, equitable funding of our schools. The reality is that when you look at the Kerwin Commission recommendations, when you look at how that $2 billion in additional funding for the schools around the state would need to be spent at the poorer districts, whether it's Dorchester or whether it's Baltimore, are going to need more. And we should be focused in every case on making sure that we have the money, but also the management, the effective management of that money to lift the poorest children in our state's educational attainment. If you talk to leaders in countries like Singapore, where they lead the world in K-12 educational outcomes, while we're always at the bottom of the world's top 30 economies, they're one or two, we're 28 or 29, they'll tell you, as they told me, you can't explain their outperformance relative to ours without understanding the fact that the gap between how their poor kids perform and how their rich kids perform is four times smaller in a country like Singapore than it is here. And so in America, we race the poor. You know, we tend to sort of pretend like all the poor are black or brown, but the reality is there's so many more white people. There's always more poor whites than poor blacks or brown people in our country and in our state. And a lot of young people across our state are suffering because we are not investing enough in their education. And when I'm governor, we'll fix that. We'll fix that in Baltimore City, and we'll fix that on the Eastern Shore and in Western Maryland and a lot of places in between.
I should say that on Facebook, Flo writes that she thinks it's a great idea for using the Power to the States movement to advance health care. She says, you know, it's basically taking Republican platform states' rights, which of course is code for a whole lot of things.
You just got to flip it against. I mean, this is a weird dystopian moment. We got to use every tool at our disposal. Mm-hmm. If there's power in our state to move our people forward, let's use it, because Donald Trump is trying to take us backwards as fast as he can.
When it comes to education, you've called for free college tuition. Yeah. That sounds expensive.
Yeah,
I hear them saying.
You know, look, we're not going to get there in a day. We can do a lot very quickly to make our colleges much more affordable, to make our community colleges free. But let's understand something. You know, if you look at, again, 1970, University of Maryland School of Law, tuition was $410. Today it would be $2,600 if it kept up with inflation, but it's $31,000. That has real impacts for all of us. Now, what appears to be driving it is that in that same period, as the state spent less and less on public higher education, it spent more and more on incarceration. As the president of Penn State said to me once, when I asked him his biggest leadership challenge, he said, "Oh, it's like Groundhog Day. Every year I go up to the state capitol, try to keep so much more money from going to the state pen, so just a little more can come to Penn State." And so what I've said is that we can make some big steps very quickly, and then we will need to basically tie increases in public higher education funding in part to decreases in incarceration funding.
And Ben Jealous, I'm sorry, we're going to have to leave it there. We have run out of time. It's always good to see you, and we shall stay in touch as the campaign proceeds.
It's great to see you, Tom. It's a real pleasure to be here. Thank you very much.
Ben Jealous is a Democratic candidate for governor and the former president and CEO of the NAACP. We've got a link to the Ben Jealous campaign website at WIPR.org/midday. Early voting in the June primary begins in 83 days. That's it for us today. Coming up Monday, Maryland Attorney General Brian Frosch will be my guest. Plus, we'll have a recap of tomorrow's March for Our Lives in Washington. We'll talk to a seventh grader from Hampstead Hill Academy here in Baltimore. She's attending the march, and we'll get her take on what happened. That's coming up midday on Monday. Thanks to Bottoms Up Bagels for providing lunch today. Bottoms Up Bagels is a small patch pop-up bagel shop preparing hand-rolled New Jersey-style bagels, house-cured lox, and special specialty cream cheeses inspired by traditions of bagel making dating back to the 1940s. Available at the Waverly and JFX Farmers Markets and online, ordering at bottomsofbagels.com. Midday's director and engineer is Luke Spicknall. Rob Sivek, Sienna Greaves, and Kathleen Cahill produce our program. Jamila Krempel is our digital producer. Austin Coughlin from Clean Cuts wrote and recorded the Midday theme music. Thanks again for listening. Thanks for following us on Twitter. Thanks for downloading our podcast. And thanks for your wonderful support during our pledge drive. We appreciate it. I'm Tom Hall. Have a great weekend.